starts out with the statement that not only is Jesus the author of our faith, but he's the finisher of our faith. And it brings out the fact that he, as you said earlier, who began a good work in us, will complete that work.
And that is why Paul could pray for them with joy, because he knew that what he was asking for, that they should be brought to completeness in the things of God, would one day be an actual fact. Whether through the process of discipline and learning on their part, or whether at the rapture, until the day of Jesus Christ. And so, I think this is the track that we're on. God will work with us, God will discipline us. I see Jacob as a piece of clay. And if there's anything ugly and messy and dirty looking, unprepossessing, it's a lump of unformed clay. And that's what most of us looked like when we got saved, I'm afraid. Or like in the hands of the master potter. Or like a hunk of iron. And he's going to make something very special out of it. Now, it doesn't take too much discipline, too much battering, beating, heating in the furnace and working on the anvil to make, for example, a peg. But I tell you, if there's something that has to be polished, ground, and shaped, and sharpened, and polished to make, for example, a surgeon's scalpel out of it, or some kind of a surgical instrument, then there's a lot more work goes into it. And so the more useful we are to be, the more precious the instrument, the greater will be the degree of work on the original block of material. Now, I know that you don't hammer a surgeon's thing on the anvil. I'm well aware of that. But I'm just taught, it all came from metal. It all went through furnaces. It all went through grinding and all kinds of processes. We are instruments in the hand of God. That's Jacob. This is the discipline. We must get on with Jacob, okay? Otherwise, we're going to get stuck. Just read with me. This is the raw material, and it's not very promising. In Hebrews 11, the finished article is summed up in the words, dying, blessing, worshiping, leaning. Every one of those is a contradiction of what Jacob was in the first instance. He was very far from dying. He's a very active person. He's just going at it there. He knows what he wants, and he's going to get it. He can plan all sorts of schemes, not only with his father and his brother and his mother, but I tell you what, he can go up over the Golan Heights and he can take on old Laban, who was a shark like himself, and he can manipulate cattle, he can manipulate costs, processes, and bookkeeping, and the whole works. He's a really smart fellow, a sharpie. Not a very likable character, though, is he? Now he's not looking, in Hebrews, he's not looking for blessing for himself. He is changed. He is a blesser. And will you just spare another moment? For what does it matter if we don't follow the books, if we get some things in our hearts and heads? Think of him coming into his later years. And he walks into the presence of the greatest and wealthiest monarch in the whole earth, the Pharaoh. Now, I suggest to you that at an earlier day in his life, if his son had been prime minister and secretary of the treasury of Egypt, Jacob would have been honing his old razor and saying, I'm going to get something out of this. My son, the head man in Egypt, and I'm going in to talk to Pharaoh? You wait till you see. I'll come out of here with something. He doesn't ask for a thing. And a most amazing thing happens. Pharaoh can't give this man anything at all. He gives to Pharaoh. He lifts up his hand and he blesses the Pharaoh. Isn't that amazing? You see, he's no longer the getter. He's the giver. But the amazing thing is that the wealthiest man in the world can give this old fellow nothing that he wants. And I suggest to you that it's summed up in those words, Joseph, my son, is alive. I will arise and go.
Amen.
And, of course, Joseph, you know, who he's a picture of, the vine whose branches ran over the wall. He's in Egypt. Now the old fellow says, I don't want anything from you. I'm sure Pharaoh expected this, because don't forget, he was a Jew. And they usually know what they want, and they usually also know how to get it. By the way, Barbara is partly Jewish. Yes. Go ahead, Larry.
I didn't know what to do.
Interesting in the life of Jacob that his worship, which is recorded in Genesis chapter 47:31, where he bowed himself upon the bed's head, where he leaned on his staff and worshiped, that worship occurred after he had secured the promise that his burial place would not occur in Egypt. And it's interesting that you just bring out the point that perhaps at an earlier stage in Jacob's life, he would have been opportunistic. But now the only thing he's concerned with is the same thing that Abraham had, a grave.
The land.
The land. Connection with the land.
And Joseph, too.
Yeah.
Carry my bones.
Yeah.
They carried a coffin out of Egypt. So we have a total change. However, he goes in and he blesses the wealthiest man in the world who had everything. You know, what do you give to the man who has everything? Well, he knew what to give him, and he said, the blessing of Almighty God be upon me. The next time we see him blessing, he's blessing Joseph's two sons. Now, that is an up of 100%, isn't it? Pardon? An increase. An increase of 100%. I'm not very good at mathematics, but I think that going from one to two is 100%. Here is a jump in an old man of 100% in the blessing he's bringing to other people. Isn't that good? But in the very next chapters, he's blessing 12 sons. Now, I'm out of my depth there. Some of you fellows can scribble the figures down and tell me what the percentage of increase is there. From 1 to 2, 100%, but from 2 to 12. Now, that is a jump. Wouldn't you be glad if your life were increasingly profitable? That if today you were a blessing, we do sing in our hymn, don't we? Make me a blessing to someone today. But wouldn't it be wonderful, and I feel so sad sometimes that it's not that way with me, that here is a man away, he said, compared with my ancestors, my fathers, my days have been few and sad. I haven't achieved the years of my fathers. But he's doing what his fathers never did, and he was the scamp, and he's blessing one man. But then the next time he's blessing two men, then 12 men. But from the 12 sons, he then launches out into the blessing of the 12 tribes. Now, has any of you got enough courage to work on your little computer and tell me what that percentage is? And then he overleaps all the centuries, and he carries the blessing of the 12 tribes right to the consummation of the kingdom. And that is this bloke who was a cheat and a self-serving egotist to begin with. So there's some hope for the rest of us, isn't there? God's discipline on this man was really something. But it was worth the while. The process in chapters 25 of Genesis to chapter 45, we have the process, the training in God's school. In Genesis 25, verse 23, and I think we should glance at these as we go along. Genesis 25, and we'll be just following kind of chapter after chapter here. 25 at 23. Hope I've got it right. The Lord said unto her, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be born of thee. The one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. Now that is the purpose of God. It is not fact yet. It's purpose. The purpose of God. In chapter 25, Jacob gets the birthright by scheming. In other words, he falls into the same trap as his forefathers, rushing God, running ahead of God. He wasn't rushing God, he was running ahead of God. He was running, an end run on God. Is that the word in football? He was getting around God. He was going to get this the quick way. Gentlemen, there are no quick ways to this. God's school is not a quickie course, and you don't get it by just pushing a button. In chapter 27, that's in 25, he gets the birthright. In 27, he gets the blessing. Now, that's different, and it's higher. Then God steps in to make him a channel of blessing, a process which culminates in 47:10, 48:20, and 49:28, and those are the three blessing periods that I mentioned. Pharaoh, the two sons of Joseph, the 12 sons, his own 12 sons, the 12 tribes to eternity. Now look at them. The steps leading to this are as follows. Bethel, the discipline of meeting God. Now, we're back to something that we mentioned in connection with Abraham, didn't we? That all his life was taken up with a succession of meetings with God in which God revealed things to him and instructed him. Now, here it's something different. It's not revealing things to him and instructing him. It's disciplining him. I'm just looking to make sure when we stop. 3:45. These comings of God to him, in this case, are different because, lost my place here, it's a meeting in discipline. This man had just taken a shortcut. It would appear that he thought there was a great distance between heaven and earth. He thought, God, I can do this. Of course the blessing is a spiritual thing. Of course the birthright is a spiritual thing. And that he should have been keen to get it was what made him different from Esau, because Esau is called a profane man. Now that doesn't mean he used profane language. Please, let's read up on our dictionaries a little bit. Profane simply means unspiritual. We used to, in school, when I was there, we studied secular history. But it wasn't called secular history then. It was called profane history. And church history was called sacred history. So you had sacred history and you had profane history. Not that it had anything to do with profanity. And it hasn't when it calls Esau a profane man. He wasn't a swearer. It means he was a man with no spiritual perception. Spiritual things had no value. So he sold the blessing and the birthright for nothing. For a bowl of soup. Or maybe it was a bowl of stew. I wouldn't know. Now he meets with God. He said, I never knew that heaven was as close to earth. Now, we've got these lovely, the chorus, climbing Jacob's ladder, climbing. It was a ramp. It wasn't a wooden ladder with rungs on it at all. The word apparently indicates some kind of a ramp, perhaps with stages on it, and it would be earthen. And there are angels parading up and down on it. Now, if ever we get into the subject of angels, then we're in deep trouble so far as my views on angels are concerned. But anyway, the Old Testament teems with them. Maybe you can tell me sometime why they have no place in the epistles. He sees that heaven is not far away, that it's short enough that a ramp connects it. And he sees these heavenly beings up and down, this constant communication. And he sees that he's at the lower part of this ramp, and he sees God at the top. He said, I never knew that. I didn't know that God was in this place. See, there was no church building, there was no temple, there was no sacred place, there was no altar. Now, he was going to put something up, but that's not the point. This is just the bush. This is bush country. This is forest. I'm out in the night, and this is it. And God is right there. God is right there. That's the first lesson. That God is intimately interested in every individual here. He knows every name. He knows every capacity. And every lack of capacity. He knows our educational standards. And those of us who have very little. Though I do make a distinction, by the way, between schooling and education. Because I've known people who had as many certificates as would paper the bathroom, and they wouldn't have enough wit to come in out of the rain. This man was in the school of God. God knew all about him, and the night God saved me, he knew exactly what I was. And it was an ignorant, unnoticed, little country yokel from nowhere but a poor home. He knew. To this day, he knows every thought. He knows every feeling. He knows every hurt, every tear, every failure, every sin, every weakness of this particular person and of you. And that was Jacob's first lesson. I tell you, that is some discipline. Thou, God, seest me. Is tremendous. You see, the people in the House and the Senate, they don't know these things. The people in the highest universities of the United States or Canada or the UK or wherever, God hath hidden these things from the wise and prudent, and he's opening them up to you, and he knows all about you. And that's a good lesson to learn at the very beginning. I cannot deceive God. I cannot pull a wool over his eyes. I may deceive other people into thinking that I'm something, or that I'm, you know, holier than I am. J.N. Darby, and pardon me for quoting him once in a while, but he was a very wonderful man in spite of mistakes. He once said, what I am in the presence of God, that I am and nothing more. Now, you should remember that one. What I am in the presence of God, that I am and nothing more. Jacob learned that. That was step one. At that same night, he also learned that no wriggling would get him out of the discipline of God. I won't let you go till I have accomplished what I've talked to you about. You are now in my hands. And I'm going to pound you, and I'm going to break you, and we'll see what he finds. At Paddan Aram, 29, chapter 29, he reaches Padan Aram. By the way, that word Aram is where the word Aramaic comes from. And that is a language, of course. Anything that's in Aram is Aramaic. They were the same stock, of course, as Abraham, but they were Arabs. They were Syrians, as a matter of fact. You remember, a Syrian ready to perish was our father. And now he has the discipline of having his own tactics used on him by others. In other words, the cheater gets cheated. That's a good discipline, too. You see, he loved one of Laban's daughters, and her name was Rachel. It's a lovely name, an absolutely lovely name. We call it Rachel, of course, but never mind. Whatever you call it, it's a beautiful name. And he said to old Laban, I'd like to marry your daughter. He didn't ask him what his prospects were. He didn't ask him if he had sufficient business acumen or education to keep his daughter in a fitting state. He said, well, you have to work for her for 7 years. How would you like that, some of you bachelors? So he worked for her for 7 years. And then he was told it's not the custom to allow the younger sister. No, he wasn't told until the next morning. It's not the custom to marry the younger daughter off before the older. And so, of course, she would be completely veiled. And if you want to know what a woman's covering is, you read that one. She was really covered. She didn't have a little pom-pom on the top of her head. She was covered. What's wrong with you, Henry? He didn't know who he'd got, you see. And that was the very thing he had done to his brother. The cheater is now cheated. Well, he said, all right, I'll take Leah. Well, he didn't have much choice, had he? I knew that happened to a fellow in Belfast, by the way. I served my apprenticeship in the shoe business. It's a Jewish practice. And there's a very wealthy Jew there. His name was Appleman. What else? Jaime Appleman. And he did business with the firm in which I worked and was in my apprenticeship at this time. A very, very lovely fellow came over from Russia whose name was Dolinsky. Abraham Dolinsky, a Russian Jew, and he came over to marry Jaime Appleman's daughter. Now, he had met the younger daughter at some big function in Paris, and that was the one he came over to marry. He discovered that Jaime Appleman had other thoughts, and so he had to marry the older one, but he couldn't get out of it the way Jacob did. This is a Jewish custom. The cheater was cheated. His own actions were coming back on his own head. There's no discipline like that. And believe me, if you spit on somebody, as sure as God's in heaven, somebody will spit on you. You take a path of self-service and you'll run up against a lot of other self-serving people, and they'll possibly be sharper than you. And you'll learn a lot. But it's much better if you use it, if you learn it God's way in his presence. So he got both of them. But he spent 14 years working for them. 3:45. It's break time. Now, we'll start in 10. Looking at disciplines. In chapter 29, we looked at the discipline of his own tactics used on him by a man just as shrewd as he is. It used to be an old saying when I was growing up, when Greek meets Greek, there is a tug of war. And these men were sharp, both of them. Very, very keen, sharp businessmen out for the gain, and they clashed. And he had all his own tricks played back on him about the cattle, about the wives, about the cattle, and about everything else. But now there was something else. Chapter 29 and chapter 30, and we can only glance here and there at what developed. And what developed was family friction. There was friction between the two sisters. After he marries, of course, verse 30 of chapter 29, he went in also unto Rachel, and he loved Rachel also, and he loved also Rachel more than Leah, and served with him yet 7 years. And when the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Now there's the discipline starting. The one that he loved, God says, I'm going to teach you a lesson. You'll have to wait my time. And so there are no children so far by Rachel. But Leah, that is the older sister, refers to her eyes a little bit earlier. Leah was tender-eyed. Now, apparently, the real meaning there is that there was something wrong with her eyes, that she had weak eyes or something deficient in her eyes. So, she conceives and bears a son and calls his name Reuben. And she said, surely the Lord has looked upon my affliction, therefore my husband will love me. And she conceived again, bore a son, and she called him Simeon. Now we have the 12 tribes, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and so on, all down the way. And she conceived again and bore a son and said, now this time will my husband become attached to me because I have borne him 3 sons. Therefore was his name called Levi. She conceived again, bore a son, and said, now will I praise the Lord. Therefore she called his name Judah, and ceased bearing. Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister, said unto Jacob, give me children or else I die. And of course it wasn't his fault, apparently. God had dealt with her. And Jacob's anger was kindled. Now, I don't want to go into this whole story because it's too long for our purposes. I have summed it up in the notes that part of this discipline of God was the discipline of family friction. Wives, children, servants. And do I need to go into this in any depth? Or have we observed, or perhaps even suffered, the discipline of this? And it is no mean discipline. Men have married women who were not Christians and found out that this was going to be a lifelong discipline of patience, because, of course, once married, so far as I am concerned, always married. Also, of course, there have been wives who have married husbands, and what goes the one way goes the other. There have been cases, of course, where family have entered into it. Not only family causing friction and trouble and strain in the home. If you had treated the boy differently, he would have been different. You know, you were too harsh with him, or, you know, it was you who spoiled him, you know, that kind of thing. Family friction is a reality. And as long as there are two people married to each other, there's going to be a certain amount of tension. Because one of them is a woman, one of them is a man. Their makeup is different. Their personalities are different, for which we thank God. Wouldn't it be terrible to be married to a man? My goodness. But... but The thing is that the man is told in Scripture he's to love the wife, and this is not Hollywood love, you know, that you fall into. I get fed up with this Hollywood concept of love falling into. The Bible says, love your wives. That's a command. It's something you're told to do. But there can be strains in this. The man is stronger. The man is usually more driving, more impulsive. He's the male figure. And the woman is gentler, for which we're truly grateful. Her whole temperament is different. There are going to be strains here, and this is part of, you know, a part of this discipline. And what a wonderful thing it is when we respond to that discipline and learn from it and grow in it and by it and become more and more one, each acknowledging. Husbands, love your wives. Wives, subject to your husbands. Children, obey your parents. But fathers, be very careful how you treat the children, and don't stir them to wrath, because there's a penalty for that too. And so these are the family problems. And of course, what about in-laws? Now that's something again. And he was involved in this, you see. He was serving his father-in-law, who was a real old shark. And that's a bit of a problem. But that's a problem that some people also have to adjust to. When a mother-in-law becomes sick and has to come home, be cared for by her son-in-law and her daughter, as very often happens, these are all strains. Jacob had to go through this. He'd never been in this before, of course, and now he got a double dose of it because he had not one wife, but two wives, and he had two servant women who had been given to him as concubines. So he had all these problems multiplied by four. So I leave the rest to your imagination. Now, chapter 31, Paddan Aram Phil, the discipline of criticism and accusation. He's criticized. Laban's sons accuse him of stealing. And all kinds of things come up. That's chapter 31, if I've got it right. And he heard the words of Laban's sons, that is his brothers-in-law, saying, Jacob hath taken away all that was our father's, and of that which was our father's hath he gotten this wealth. And Jacob beheld the countenance of Laban, and behold, it was not toward him as before. Jacob is becoming a very thoroughly chastened man. And so he calls, sends for Rachel and Leah to the field, and he takes off. He thinks he can run away from the discipline. And so he runs away. Now, it's a long hike. As I say, you must keep in touch with your Bible geography. He's away up by the sources of the Euphrates River.
Back to Haran.
Pardon?
Back to Haran. Where Abraham was when his father died.
That is right. He's right back to the sources of the Euphrates at Haran. And so he starts off for home. Now he has now four wives of one grade and quality of another. And he has a lot of children. He has a lot of cattle. And this is a very daunting task. And then suddenly he becomes aware of the fact that his old father-in-law is coming behind him with the cavalry. And they meet. And that meeting is really something. Look at a couple of verses in chapter 32. Is it 32? No. 31. Has to be 31. Yes. Verse 25. Then Laban overtook Jacob. There's a mistake there. You better correct it on the paper. It's all right. 31. But at verse 25. Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mount, and Laban and with his brethren, the whole bunch, he had a whole crowd with him, in the mount of Gilead. Laban said to Jacob, what hast thou done? And so on, they start chaffering with each other. And you have not permitted me to kiss my sons and my daughters and have done foolishly in so doing. You see, he thought he could run away from the problem, and you really never can run away from the problem, because the problem was that he took the problem with him. And that was himself and the four wives. The principal problem being still himself. He thinks he can wangle his way out of anything, this fellow. He has been through the school. He has read all the business manuals. He knows how to succeed. He knows all about input and output and profitability and cash flow. And he's got all this, and he thinks he can apply it to the spiritual life. Have you seen any shadowings of that around among ourselves? And now they meet, and they're going to have this thing out. And Jacob, he gives his excuses. Because I was afraid, verse 31, perhaps thou wouldest take by force thy daughters from me. He knew better than to try that. With whomsoever thou findest thy gods, because of course the god has been stolen, Rachel did it, and she lied about it, and so on. Now they had gathered up some baggage that Jacob may not even have been aware of, one doesn't know. Verse 36, Jacob was angry and contended, argued, flogged it out with Laban, and Jacob answered and said to Laban, what is my trespass? What is my sin? He was full of both. Whereas thou hast searched my furniture, that is all my belongings, my baggage, and hast not found thy household furniture, idols, whatever they were, set it here before my brethren and thy brethren, that they may judge between us. This 20 years, now he starts with his complaint. This is the argument for the defense. And he gets down to verse 42 before he bothers to mention the name of God. And I think this might be the first place in which he does. Odd, isn't it? All these years. Now he says, except the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac. Now, the fear of Isaac, the fear of, that's a name for God. The God who causes fear, or for of whom and for whom we have fear. It's the name of God. And the fear, except the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, had been with me, surely thou hadst sent me away empty. God hath seen my affliction and the labor of my hands, and rebuked thee last night. And Laban answered and said, these daughters are my daughters. These children are my children, this cattle, and so on. Now therefore come thou, let us make a covenant. I am thou, and let it be a witness, let it be for a witness between me and thee. They're up practically on the Golan Heights, by the way. Jacob took a stone and set it up for a pillar. Jacob said unto his brethren, gather stones. They took stones, made a heap, and they did eat there upon the heap. And Laban called it Jegar Shahadutha. But Jacob called it Galeed. Jacob said, this heap is a witness between me and thee this day. Therefore was the name of it called Galeed. And Mizpah, that would be, of course, in his name. For he said, the Lord watch between me and thee when we were absent, when we are absent one from the other. Now, in days gone by, husbands used to buy, especially if they were going away from time to time, they used to buy very beautiful little mother-of-pearl brooches for their wives to wear. And on that brooch, it said Mizpah. And the meaning of it was very emotional, of course, and very sentimental. And it meant the Lord watch between me and thee. Unfortunately, that's not the interpretation at all. However, they had a lot of joy out of it, so we won't knock it out of them. Most of them are dead now anyway. Mizpah was the very opposite. They put up a pillar, and he said, you old rascal, Laban, the Lord watch between thee and me, right? If you come past this pillar to come in my direction, may God curse you. In effect, that's what he's saying. And, of course, Laban said, okay, by me, the same to you. So, so there they are. Neither parted. And this is, one would think, settled. Yes, sir.
Brother, isn't that Laban's saying? Verse 48, Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me this day. Therefore, its name was called Galeed, also Mizpah, because he said, may the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from another.
That is true. That is true. But it was a mutual thing. Jacob didn't want Laban to come to him any more than Laban wanted Jacob to come to him. They separated, and as far as we know, they never met again. It was Laban's initiative, but it was an oath which they took between them. Jacob took a stone and set it up for a pillar. Jacob said to his brethren, gather stones. Laban called it Jager Shadutha. Jacob called it Galeed. And the interpretation of that is, of course, Mizpah, from Aramaic to Hebrew. So Jacob was as much involved as Laban was by that word in verse 47. Jacob called it Galeed. I think it was a mutual thing. They agreed part. The partition of the country. Now that was a sad discipline. Now in chapter 32, which we seem to have dropped out of the notes somehow or other, the right place, we have Jabbok there, but Jacob went his way and the angels of God met him, and when Jacob saw them, he said, this is God's host, and he called the name of that place Machaneim. Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, unto the land of Seir, the country of Edom, which is away down in the south east corner of the land. And he commanded them, saying, thus shalt thou speak unto my lord Esau, and thy servant Jacob is come, and so on and so on and so on. And now he's still working on things. The messengers returned, saying to Jacob, we came to thy brother Esau, also he cometh to meet thee, and 400 men with him. And Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that were with him, the flocks, the herds, the camels, into two bands. And he said, if Esau come to the one company and smite it, the other company which is left shall escape. Now, I don't know which company he put Leah in and which company he put Rachel in. He was a bit of a trickster, this boy. He's still working in the strength and smartness of the flesh. So he divides everything up and he sends one across the river. And he says, if he kills one lot, at least I'll be left with the other lot. And then he starts praying. Now, this is the first time we have him praying. Now, he may have prayed before. We don't know. But as far as I know, this is the first record of praying since he started on this trek. And he said, O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, the Lord who saidst unto me, return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. I am not worthy of the least of all thy mercies and of all thy truth which thou hast shown unto thy servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. Deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, he will come and smite me there with the children. And thou saidst, I will surely do thee good, and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered. Remember, God had said, the stars of the sky and the dust of the earth, now it's the sand of the sea. And he lodged there that same night, took of that which came to his hand a present for Esau, his brother, 200 she-goats, 20 he-goats, 200 ewes, and so on, 30 milk camels, and delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by themselves, and said unto his servant, pass over before me, and put a space between drove and drove. Now, what he's trying to do...